First to the US, where we join Daniel McCarthy, columnist for The Spectator USA and editor of Modern Age, a conservative review. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks.
May we begin with Donald Trump and US foreign policy, with Venezuela teetering on the brink. And of course, given the long history of US meddling in the politics of Latin America, what's the Trump administration's position on Venezuela and the embattled Maduro?
Well, so far, the Trump administration has been very outspoken in calling for Nicolas Maduro to step aside and to let Juan Guaido take power. And the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has said that the United States is, you know, willing to consider all options, including military options, as a means to depose Maduro. Now, as of now, there doesn't seem to be any real momentum afoot in order to have a direct U.S. intervention. But there's certainly sort of past precedent for this kind of thing.
Are there isolationist tendencies and reticence within the administration?
It's hard to say whether or not within the administration. Donald Trump himself had in 2016 run as a candidate who had seemingly strong non-interventionist or isolationist tendencies, and who signaled to the American public and to voters that he was going to keep the United States out of most foreign conflicts. But the administration at this point is rather full of advisors like John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and for that matter, Elliot Abrams, who is more or less explicitly a neoconservative and a foreign policy hawk.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the term neocon has sort of dropped out of common parlance since the invasion of Iraq. But as you point out, it's alive and well in Washington, D.C.
Many of the most prominent neoconservatives who were in journalism have been outspoken critics of Donald Trump, whether it's Bill Kristol or David Frum, who had been a speechwriter for George W. Bush. However, in terms of the administration's own foreign policy staff, there are a number of people who certainly resemble the kind of policy positions that one identifies with neoconservatives. And in the case of Elliot Abrams, he's someone who that label has been affixed to for over 30 years.
You point out that, in a sense, this cluster, a packaging together Maduro, Cuba, and Russia, as if they're a revived communist threat. You talk about 1980s nostalgia.
It's something of a flashback. Donald Trump has said that, he's incensed with Cuba because Cuba has placed perhaps as many as 20,000 troops and other advisors in Venezuela. And then Russia is also supporting the Maduro regime. So there is this sense of sort of a Cold War, Third World replay going on right now, where the United States is, looking at Cuba and Russia as sort of competitive powers here, as well as Venezuela itself, and is has a bone to pick with all three of them.
One is reminded of Colin Powell's Pottery Barn statement about U.S. intervention in Iraq, heavens above, 2003, and I quote, "You break it, you own it." Surely that's relevant here.
It is, but it may be that the United States anticipates rather less chaos taking place in Venezuela if Maduro is overturned than we saw take place in Iraq with the deposition of Saddam Hussein. Time will tell, of course. You never know with these sorts of upheavals whether they're going to wind down fairly quickly or whether they will in fact become years-long civil wars or other kinds of disruptions. And certainly if the United States gets directly involved, it's going to create the impression that this is Donald Trump's war.
How would that play out globally? How would Putin react to that? How would China react to that?
The irony here is that many of the United States' strategic rivals around the world would, on the surface, create quite a big stink about it. But in fact, they might like to see the United States, in a rather tangled situation in its own hemisphere. And just as with the Iraq War, Iran was one of the great strategic victors of that conflict. There may be a sense in which some of the United States' enemies would, in fact, or rivals, I should say, might be quite happy to see the United States in a mess that could be quite difficult to get extracted from.
We're talking to my favorite conservative, Daniel McCarthy, columnist for The Spectator USA and editor of Modern Age, a conservative review. Getting Maduro out, how do the Democrats feel about that? I know that there's no monolithic Democrat view, but how would it play in domestic politics?
It would probably play fairly well. And this is one of the maybe one of the elements that's pushing the Trump administration to embrace a more neoconservative and hard line. Because in the United States, there's still this tendency where foreign policy is concerned, especially a more hawkish kind of foreign policy, for both parties to unite behind the president. So with the president facing a great deal of political difficulty on Capitol Hill right now over the Mueller report, the foreign policy may seem like a kind of escape valve in a place where Democrats would still defer to the president.
Let's go to another part of the globe where America has shown a keen interest, and that, of course, is Iran. The U.S. seems determined to increase pressure there.
Yes. Week by week and month by month, the Trump administration seems to find new devices with which to escalate pressure on Tehran. Right now, there is, the administration has announced as of this month, it is no longer going to issue waivers on the various kinds of sanctions that it applies to Iran. And the effect of this is going to be to try to reduce Iran's oil exports to absolutely nothing. And, most experts do expect to see half or two-thirds of Iran's oil exports to drop off within the next few weeks.
Incidentally, oil is important. No one's really accusing the U.S. of being after Venezuela's oil because it's known to have the largest reserves in the world. But your country no longer is desperate for oil imports.
Well, it's very interesting how these forces are playing out. So both Iran and Venezuela especially are oil powers, both of which are obviously facing some rather tough pressure from the United States. Saudi Arabia says that it's going to increase its oil output in order to offset the shock to the oil market from taking Iranian oil in particular off of the market. And the United States does have the ability to start producing more oil through extracting it from shale resources. But that's expensive. And Saudi Arabia actually wants to keep the price of oil sufficiently low that the United States doesn't have an incentive to start tapping more of its shale reserves, because that in turn would put so much oil on the market that it would in fact cause problems for Saudi Arabia. So there's this very complicated set of economic and diplomatic considerations in play.
But of course, other countries are not as well positioned as the U.S. to live without oil.
No, in particular, China has been a major importer of Iranian oil, and there seems to be some difficulty of China, finding new sources for oil to replace what it's been getting from Iran. Right now, there is an Iranian oil tanker with about $1 billion worth of oil just sitting in one of the ports in China. So China is eager to find some alternative and is eager to try to conform to the U.S. sanctions regime because, Chinese businesses, especially large ones, want to continue doing business in the United States. And that would be virtually impossible if they were to openly defy the sanctions.
So let's talk about this. What sort of leverage does the U.S. have in getting other countries to help squeeze the Iranians?
Well, this is probably the most sort of unilateral power that the United States wields. For all that the U.S. obviously has a very large military and a great deal of sort of technical advantage over other countries in sort of direct military questions, when it comes to economic power, the United States has sort of a headlock on the world financial system. And that's for good reason. I mean, the U.S. does have a high degree of financial transparency, especially relative to someplace like China. It has very deep capital markets, which means that you can transfer a lot of money into U.S. markets fairly speedily and safely in a way that you can't really do with either Chinese or European markets. So this means that U.S. financial regulations and U.S. financial sanctions can affect almost any company in the world, because everyone wants to have either be doing business in the U.S. market or else at least be using U.S. Capital markets. And this is something, there are no financial countermeasures right now open to China or anyone else. But that doesn't mean that they won't be annoyed enough that they might turn to non-financial countermeasures.
My next guest tonight is Sergio Romano, who was Italy's ambassador to NATO, and I know that he will be arguing that NATO is out of relevance, run out of puff, and should be dismantled. So on that, at least he and Trump are in broad agreement. But I wonder about Trump's support for North Macedonia joining NATO.
Just this week, the Trump administration sent to the U.S. Senate a appeal to go ahead and approve North Macedonia's accession into NATO. Here again, Donald Trump had come into office as someone who was quite critical of NATO, who thought that its members were not paying sufficient dues to the organization. And NATO expansion is kind of the last thing I think many Trump voters were expecting his administration to take on. But NATO expansion has been a consistent policy under the last several United States administrations, going back to George H.W. Bush, really. So for 25 or 30 years now, this has gone on, no matter whether it's been a Republican or a Democrat in office, and now apparently even Donald Trump, with all the disruption and surprises he brings to the U.S. Government, Donald Trump is still following the same pattern as his predecessors.
If we go back a couple of months, and now I'm switching to the presidential elections, if we go back a couple of months when Joe Biden was umming and ahhing, I remember Trump tweeting to the effect that he'd probably be the more formidable contender. But it seemed to me that might have been a case of Brer Rabbit in the briar patch. Would Trump really be concerned with a Biden candidacy?
He seems to be concerned about it. He does, seem to have a certain degree of aversion to seeing Joe Biden as the Democratic Party's nominee for next year. Biden is, quite popular in many of the states that Donald Trump needs to win, particularly places like Pennsylvania, where Biden claims a certain amount of historical connection. He's a senator from Delaware, but Pennsylvania is also a kind of mid-Atlantic state and is quite culturally similar. So I think Donald Trump genuinely is concerned about the potential of Joe Biden to pull away the support he needs for re-election.
But you're not. You were right that Biden is Obama without the hope, and that he offers voters no change.
I think that Joe Biden is kind of a nostalgia candidate at this point, given not only his age, he's a few years older than Donald Trump, but also the fact that when he runs for president, when Biden is out on the campaign trail, I think his strongest selling point is to claim that he is Barack Obama's heir. He was Obama's vice president, so he can plausibly make that case. But his own record as a U.S. senator is something that, in fact, would be quite difficult for his own party to swallow. Biden supported the Iraq War, for example. Biden supported very tough on crime measures in the 1990s that Democrats are now quite critical of. And Joe Biden was an opponent of measures to sort of end school segregation, going back, decades further. So all of these things are liabilities for Biden when he runs on his own record. He can run on the Obama record, but I think that Americans comparing the Obama record to the Trump record may see that, the U.S. has had more economic growth under Trump so far, that unemployment has been lower, and in general, the Trump years seem to be quite favorably comparable to the Obama years.
I've just heard a vast intake of breath from my generally left-wing listeners, Daniel, but thanks for that. Daniel McCarthy, columnist for The Spectator USA.